Tim Weisberg interview, April 12, 1975.
Look at that.
Oh my god.
So I'm just going to ask you a couple of newsy type questions. You're going to have the interview for the station. I work for the news department.
Do you want to do us first and then do them?
Yeah, I'm just. Okay. It's just going to be really short. You know, right. It's just for the news director, so they can run something Monday on the news.
Okay. I'm going to take your picture, so watch. I'm going to put my camera back together again.
What did you think of the Cal Poly audience tonight?
I think it was one of the best audiences we've ever played for. Very responsive. I mean, you could tell. I mean, we could tell the minute we started playing that they were listening to every note, and that's exciting. I mean, it just the show, it just kind of snowballs and it feeds on itself, and it really makes it very, very nice.
How'd you get that idea for those two echo boxes that you use?
I heard that. I guess the first horn players to use those were Don Ellis. I think Eddie Harris used it. Even Paul Horn started, and this is when they first started to amplify horns. So that had to be back like around 1968 or 67. I kind of liked it, and so I borrowed one, and I tried to see whether I could, if I enjoyed playing through it, basically. There are certain devices I don't like. I don't like ring modulators. I don't feel like I can create anything with it. And I just, I had a real affinity for it. Kind of like when I started playing the flute, I wanted to play drums. They wanted me to play flute. I started, and after my first lesson, I dug it. I mean, the music I heard in my head came out of that particular instrument. That's why I've never taken another one. Same with the Echoplex.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that they said the reason you started playing the flute because they had a shortage in the band and you needed somebody to play flute?
That's exactly correct. Really, supply and demand. Plus, the band director, his specialty was flute. He was a really fine flute player and a really good teacher. And so he prevailed upon me and my parents. And that was it, supply and demand. It might have been different if they needed trumpets, I'm not sure. I know I wouldn't have picked flute, you know, like out of the right off the top of my head.
How long have you been playing flute?
About 18 years. Yeah, 18
That's
years.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
What's your plans for the future?
Well, let's see. I'm going to sleep tonight.
I mean, music. I got one of those the other night. Just blew me away. I asked a mountain climber, when's his next climb going to be? And he goes, day after tomorrow. Just burn me.
Let me give you a little better answer. I mean, to project between now and it's funny. I still think in semesters. I mean, that's what it did to me. I mean, I still think, you know, in semesters. I think September to January, and then February to June, and then summer. Basically, what's happening is we've been out on the road for 2 months. We'll go back out on the road again in a week. More or less till the middle of May, and then schools are wrapping it up, even the ones on the quarters, you know, finals and things like that. And then we're going to do another album during the summer, do some concerts. I think we're going to do the Santa Monica Civic in L.A., and the album should come out in September, and then we'll start touring again.
Which album do you think that, you know, projects you know, the most of yourself, you know, the one that you really get into? Which one do you like the best?
The fourth one. I mean, It has the furthest progression of what I've been trying to put together, which is an ensemble sound. To contrast, like that tune, Because of Rain, that real soft, pretty thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the more conventional lead instrument floating on top of a rhythm section, which I love to do, but I think it makes it even prettier or nicer when you've got something to contrast it with a lot of ensemble things taking place. So I think the fourth one has that developed as far as I've been able to develop it with the group, and we're going to take it a little further in the next one. In addition to having some of those really pretty things, you know, maybe just hear flute and vibes or something like that on something.
Do you think you'd like to come back to Cal Poly and play again?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we'd love to come back. I'd like to come back I've got some friends up here at Warehouse Sound. I guess I can say that. They're friends.
They're great people.
They
throw some wild parties over the grain.
They are probably the most unusual people I've ever met in the music business, because they're people. And that doesn't happen. And probably come up and spend a couple. Yeah, I'd love to come back. I know the band would love to, too.
The people that invited you to come over and party tonight, if you can get over there, I think I ripped mine to shreds, but they're going to have a third annual third quarterly two-board beer festival.
Oh, my God.
A day in the sun?
Are we really going to put this on the news?
We're going to really track it.
You'd be amazed what we put on the news.
Good Lord, I hope it didn't You listening over
you
there?
Did rip it
I
up.
Think I lost my tickets. Anyway, see, I tore mine to shreds tonight for.
You shouldn't have got so excited.
I know.
I mean, it was a great concert, but I mean, my
really
God.
Really back me up, but anyway.
I can't believe you ripped your coat like that over the music either. I mean, that's unbelievable for a person into the news. I mean.
Thanks, Tim.
But I'm excited about it.
You want me to make you feel better? This is my third interview. Thanks a lot. Turn it on, yeah.
Doggone it, you thought I was going to start getting smart and you stopped it.
No. Not really. I didn't want to take. See? In fact, I'll give you my tickets.
When is it? Oh, God, I'm going to be out of town. Wait a minute, when is this?
April 13th.
That's tomorrow.
No. April 13th.
No, I'm going to be April 13th.
Come back. Come back on the fog.
You know, I'm.
Get some more.
Here, you keep one. Let me keep one. Maybe I'll. Come on, am I on the road then? I don't remember.
Well, it's going to be pretty wild over at Wild Bill's place. But that's
I had to bring the band up.
You ought to. Well,
this is a beer festival, remember?
Right. It's the third quarterly two-board beer festival.
Oh, boys, they love
and
beer.
It's
yeah.
Got,
here's a minute to it.
Here's the basic rules for the day. So it says something about drink a fair share of your beer and.
The band will drink everybody's
really?
Beer. Sure. They would love it.
And don't carry outrageous amounts of illegal drugs and alcohol. To get that on tape. Anyway, you know, you're invited to come along.
I mean, hey, you know, I think we go out and then we come back and then we have to be, and then we start out in Denver on the 17th. Yeah, I might be able to make
it. Just, if you go to that party tonight, the people that are having the party tonight are sponsoring that festival, so they'll probably give you some more tickets, you know, to get in.
Spread them around Los Angeles.
Well, I think it's going to be a great patriotic. Oh, my God. Just kidding.
Oh, did we find that?
It's done.
Oh, great. Starting to fade.
I'll turn it over to you, Patty. Thanks a lot, Tim. I guess the news director's going to
fall. Don't close it till the train comes. Or is it far away?
Right.
God, we're locked in. They're pumping all the air out. Wait a minute.
Tim, does Lynn compose as much as you do? Is it like a 50-50 thing, or do you work together? Or?
It's completely all mixed up like crazy. We probably compose as much. What gets on the album and what is composed are not necessarily... There's a lot more composed than gets on the album.
Yeah.
And we've gotten the rest of the guys composing, too, so that we can kind of draw on all our talents. I mean, a lead guitar player is going to write differently than a flute player with a classical background.
Sure.
So I would say the mix is... actually, on the last album...
He locked himself out.
Oh. The mix on the last album, as far as the writing, at least if you just to look at the credits, would be predominantly Todd and Bugs. Mm-hmm. Well, some of those things would come about, like I would sit Todd down and say, hey, look, why don't we... something with rhythm guitar riff, and he'd start playing. Just, well, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Why don't you put something? And he'd come back a week later, and he'd have like a whole thing put together, or part of a thing. And I just kind of sit back, and as we work on the things, we never title them. They're titled, you know, 8 months after they're written sometimes, after we've been performing them and everything.
Yeah.
And I just kind of listen and see how everybody kind of refers to the tune. Like when we're putting a show together, one of the guys said, well, why don't we, after Because of Rain, let's do Todd's tune. The one that goes, well, fine. If that's kind of the way the vibration is in the air, then that's the way I do it. I don't even care where the names fit. Lynn's that way, too.
About 3 minutes. We'll
sure.
go on.
Yeah.
Sound good?
Yeah. Who is going to be... Okay, I just... So
are
I'm
they
going
over? No,
yeah.
Not right now.
Not yet.
They are going to tonight, though?
Sure.
I didn't know that.
Rick passed it in.
In fact, Lynn got me into writing. I didn't know nothing from writing. And he just said, hey, God, every time you play, every time you jam... You make up really far out melodies. Write it down. And then I wrote one down. He says, well, you just composed something. And then it dawned on me. That's what. Because when, you know, guys are jamming, that's what they're doing. It's instant composition.
Did you write
most
of the stuff up yourself?
It's so long ago. Some of it, yeah. It's hard. I don't even think of it that way. In fact, some of the things I do write, I don't know. Somebody will say that my name's on the credits. And I say, oh, yeah, it is. Because, like, my mind is like an orchestra director, and sometimes, like I said, I'm saying, I'm pulling it out of the guys, or I'll add something here, or I'll orchestrate, or I'll arrange it. And I sometimes lose track of which ones are officially I wrote or didn't write. You know, I don't even think of it that way. As long as the music, when it's finally finished, expresses whatever, you know, the feeling of the mood I'm trying to get across, then, you know, how it started or or what joined in, you know, along the trail of putting it together. I don't even think about it.
When'd you pick up that outrageous bass player?
Oh, God, we've been playing together 3.5 or 4 years.
Really? He looks like he's, you know, right out of college or right out of high school. You know, how old is he?
22.
He looks younger than 22,
yeah.
But he plays a mean bass.
Yeah, he does. He used to be a guitar player. I mean, he's a great, great rhythm guitar player.
I know a few guitar players that have gone to bass. I don't know if you know David Shalek. He used to play for Big Brother on the guitar.
Oh, yeah.
And then now he's playing bass for Sons of Chaplin, and he just adapts right into it.
It's a hard transition to make because usually the ego of a guitar player,
exactly.
It doesn't fit. But Bugs isn't like that. But unusual, as Todd isn't that way either. And two guys that used to be in my band, Rick Jagger from Dave Mason's band, he was in my band for about 8-9 months when Mason wasn't working, which he's just done again. Just told the band, I don't think I'm going to work.
Yeah, I
I mean, it just happened.
The Winterland show, I had tickets for it, and we went up there, and they used an excuse that his keyboard player hurt his arm or something.
Yeah, he hurt his arm because he smashed it into a wall because Mason didn't give him any notice, any of them.
Oh,
that's what happened, probably. And Jim Krieger, it's the first, I guess, my album, The Dream Speaker, was the first album he'd ever recorded on. And Mason came out, this was in 73, and heard us playing and really dug him. And it was a good opportunity for Jimmy. But Jimmy is that way, too. He's an incredible guitar player and doesn't have that ego, you know, that just makes,
yeah,
you know,
really
can be
supports
very...
Him
yeah. And I don't know, when I get to the point where I can afford it, Jimmy's going to be playing guitar with us, too, I think. So I would like to have two guitars. And we've done it before on the road. We've crossed paths, and he's jammed with us. And it's just two great lead guitar players who love to comp for the other guy. I mean, no hassles. No, and then, anyway, that's something coming in the future, too. I'm thinking about.
How are we doing?
As soon as the song ends, whenever. I'm just here waiting for the song.
Okay.
And he'll go, and we can go.
Great. And who? And you're going to be doing it?
Well, I guess everybody.
Okay,
be doing
great.
It.
These mics will pick up everything in the room?
Oh, great. Okay,
good. I'm used to having...
like taped to your mouth, hanging from your nose.
Well, now that you've recorded with Dave Mason, has anyone else asked you to play with him?
No, they all hated it. not yet, and it's really funny because the recording scene is for flute players is basically saxophone players, guys who double play all the reeds, which. I never could understand it makes financial sense because, I'll tell you. You go in and do a record session, you get $100. That's what they pay. They call you up on the phone, they say, come down, be there at 9 o'clock. You play, you get $100. If you pick up a second instrument, it's called a double, you get another $20. And then as you pick up more instruments, that works down. Well, the producer, obviously, has saved $80 if he calls a guy who plays sax and flute rather than calling a saxophone player and me. But trumpet players don't do it. The only double they have is flugelhorn. They never get asked to pick up a French horn or a trombone or a tuba or a mellophone or anything like that. String players, you never see a violin player picking up a viola or a cello or a bass.
Hold on for a second. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, it's okay.
Hopefully.
We're talking tonight with Tim Weisberg live in the studio here at KCPR. We were just discussing Tim's work with Dave Mason on his last album, and Tim was talking about playing in the studio with other people. Go right ahead.
Well, basically what I was trying to tell you is just what you asked me is if I'd work with or was being asked to work with other musicians, and like when Dave gave me a call. And it's basically an economic thing that happens. The reason when I first started, when nobody, you know, actually knew except my friends that I existed. Saxophone players do all of that playing for economic reasons. They get a double instead of having to pay two musicians scale. They can pay one musician to play two instruments or three instruments for considerably less than what the total would be for having a different man play all the instruments. So after I'd done my second album, I had Louis Shelton play some guitar on it, who produced Seals and Crofts, I think a couple of their albums. And I finally got, I think, keyed into one of the reasons why I wasn't called and haven't been called. Hopefully it's not my playing. anyway, Dave enjoyed it, and I was really flattered when he called me. But what it was is Louis came up to me and he said, Tim, would you consider playing on a session I'm doing with Seals and Crofts? And I said, God, I'd love to do it. And I thought, gee. I said, Louis, why did you say, would I consider it? You know, I mean, he was almost apologetic in asking me.
And he said, well, you know, if you're a recording artist, and I didn't know if you'd want to bother, you know, to take the time. And what had happened is I'd gone from 2 years before with no albums, nobody knew who I was, and I didn't play saxophone, to becoming a recording artist where people would feel, you know, that I was unapproachable.
Yeah.
And I think that might be, you know, what has happened. I would be selective. I mean, I love Dave's music, and so I was tickled to do it. And there's some other artists whose music I really dig, and if they called me, it would really be a gas, and it would be different than doing it as a studio musician.
Yeah.
When you do it as a studio musician, it's a craft, and you're expected to, they tell you they want you to play like, you know, Herbie Mann, I'll play this solo like Jethro Tull. I mean, Ian Anderson, I still make that mistake myself. And that's something that I really didn't want to do. That's one of the reasons I didn't take up saxophone. It's a very safe way to make a living, and you can make a lot of money, but that isn't what I wanted to do. That was something I wanted to do on my own and have some type of an identity and have something identifiable, a sound. And so when Dave called up, that's basically what he was looking for. He wanted Tim Weisberg to play the flute, not a copy of this or that. And when I asked Dave to play on our next album, I want Dave Mason to play it, not because of the specific way that he plays guitar, maybe just on one tune or something. So that was kind of long and verbose, I guess, but did that answer a little bit?
Yeah, it's great you could do that without having to rise up through the ranks of studio musicians like, you know, so many people have, like, you know, Ry Cooter or someone like that, to finally come into their own. It's good you could do what you wanted to do.
Well, I'm kind of stubborn, and it was when I started out being a flute player who didn't sing, who, with a classical background, I was playing with rock and roll bands, was, you know, they thought I was nuts. They said it wouldn't work, and
they were wrong.
Yeah, they're like, well, yeah, I think it's really gratifying because things, I mean, all around the country, places we're playing in a, that's so called, I mean, it's a recession depression. We were in Detroit. I mean, it's a depression there. I mean, when you see advertisements in the newspaper by the banks, full page, 3% car loans, that's how bad they're trying to get people in Detroit, the banks, you know, to move their money. And we drew well every place we played, and we're not a group that has like a hit album. And we are drawing, well, like last night we played in front of 3,500 people at my alma mater, Cal State Northridge, with David Steinberg, and there were 14 and 15-year-olds there. I mean, in addition to like a whole range, I mean, we get a mix of an audience that's really exciting. So, because I wasn't a saxophone player, I couldn't do it through the studios, and I didn't want to. The smart way to do it, the conservative way, would have been take up saxophone and then sit back and earn 30 or 40 grand a year, and then, you know, maybe something will happen and maybe not, but you got a living, you know, till you're 65 and stocking away in the back. But I like to get up in front of playing in front of people. And so I just thought I'd take a shot at it.
That was proven tonight after two encores and a very excellent concert.
What do you think of David Steinberg's music?
David Steinberg's music is music to my ears. I'm a Steinberg freak.
Yeah, he did he play that song, The Hold It? The one he and George Harrison, I think, wrote it.
He didn't do that. I missed part of the show because I was back trying to get, you know, my flutes put away and everything. We had a problem last night, and luckily we in the school and everybody that was at the concert was helped out. I mentioned at the concert too. The sound company that did our show last night should have been shot. They were incompetent to say the least, and they forced 3,500 people to stand in the rain for an hour and a half. Rained as hard in L.A. as it did here, and so David got up all by himself after we had played. I'd say the audience had been standing in the rain and sitting for a combination of at least 3.5 hours by the time we'd finished. He got up on the stage all by himself, and unbelievable. That's my thoughts about him. And the other thing I want to allude to is that the people at Warehouse Sound, Tom Spaulding, and all the guys, they were very kind. I think they got called at 3 o'clock this morning and asked if they could do the sound for us tonight. And I think they got right up out of bed and went down and started unpacking things out of crates. And part of the reason the concert went so well is because everybody could hear it. And the music we were making on the stage got out to the audience. And then all those feelings got back to us.
Excellent, too. Yeah. Use those
acoustic panels behind you tonight, too, to project the sound out.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't use it there in Schumach. Schumach is noted for its very bad acoustic.
It felt very good on the stage. I mean, you know, and you can tell when an audience can hear you. You can, because you do little subtle things and they respond, and then you know. And that's really exciting. I mean, you get kind of a tingly feeling, you know, like, oh, wow.
What gave you the idea for, in your first encore, you came out and you did sort of an improvisation using just the flute and the reverb. What gave you the idea for that, just off the top of your head, or?
It's something that I've been known to do fairly frequently. It's always different. And it just depends, you know, what it feels like in the room and everything. And it's something I kind of like to do. And sometimes in a concert, sometimes you don't get an encore. Sometimes you do. And for at least a first encore, it's a really nice way to kind of end the evening sometimes. I mean, sometimes everybody is so drained from a show, and we end our shows up high energy. So, you know, like I said to the audience, I mean, after you've been that high, it's kind of nice. I deal in contrast anyway to go in a completely different direction. And that's why. That was the thing.
You did it quite well at the end.
That's excellent.
No, thank you. No, we all did it together. I mean, you know, I keep saying that, but it's something that I really, it's something that I believe in and that lets me enjoy being on the road, you know, 2 or 3 months living in Holiday Inns. Because it's exciting. I mean, I remember a show like this the way I did one in Davidson, North Carolina, which was like 2 months ago. It was that kind of electricity. And we had great shows in between, but that's almost 2 months ago. And I remember Davidson, and I remember tonight, too. And I'll probably remember for, you know, a number of years. I mean, I can remember some other shows maybe 2 or 3 years ago that stand out, you know, that are just that extra something that you can't predict. You don't know what's going to happen when you get there, and it happens.
How many concerts do you do here?
It's increasing, thank God. when I said everybody thought I was nuts, that meant record companies, agents who book, and the people at venues. That means concert promoters who do shows like at the Santa Monica Civic and things like that. Concert directors at schools. They didn't know who I was. They thought that what I was trying to do was something that really wouldn't appeal to the student body. And I was on a lectures and concerts committee. And you want to do something that's successful. You don't want to take a chance. And most of the time on something that, you know, you think, oh, maybe 40 people will dig it, but guy, you know, we want to fill a gym or we want to do this or that. And so it was basically just a hard sell for about 3 years to convince people that we could play on the bill with a Dave Mason or a Cheech and Chong or Buffy St. Marie or the Guess Who, which are pretty widely varied pop audiences, and have no problem, you know, to play something that is so quiet that you can hear everybody breathing almost in front of a rock and roll audience, a screaming and yelling. I mean, I can remember promoters coming out and saying, play all the loud stuff, play all the loud stuff, because they thought there would be a riot or something, because we were the opening act. Tim who? We came to see Dave Mason. And that wasn't the case. And so it's increasing. You know, we've done two of the TV shows. We did Kirshner's rock concert, and we did the Midnight Special. And we're finding some believers now, which it makes it fun, you know. I mean, now we're being able to project 3 and 4 months in advance, and pretty soon maybe like a, you know, close to a year in advance, and that excites me.
You said you've got an album coming out, or you're going to start an album in June?
Yeah, in June.
What gives you the ideas for your album, since they're, like, there's no words on them?
Right.
And earlier I think you mentioned you don't intend to get into vocals.
That's correct.
So what gives you the ideas for your albums?
Well,
getting deep here.
No, that's okay. It's strange. It isn't, you know. I don't know. I think in moods and colors and contrasts. And many times when we're putting tunes together, I think of the tunes as how they'll fit in a show, what I want them to do. Exciting, quiet, soft. I mean, those are the things that run through my mind. Nothing, you know. That I could really, you know, verbalize. That's probably one of the reasons why I was lousy in English and didn't turn into a singer also, because I do it better that way than verbalizing anything. I mean, when you get writing, you know, into poetry or something like that, and that's what writing lyrics is.
How long have you been composing?
Well, Lynn, the first time he suggested I write something down was probably about 1969.
And that's you've been playing the flute for how long at that point?
But, well, let me stop.
Five years ago.
That's 5 years. So about 13 years. Yeah. played classical. I had a classical background, so I played in the orchestra and the symphonic wind ensemble and marching bands and rose parades and halftime shows. Yeah, all of those, sure. What key do you want me to play? Stars and Stripes Forever. But see, that's what happens to that's what a flute player does. That's,
can I ask you who your musical influences are?
Yeah. I'll take the roots, as they say. Two really great flute teachers, Bob Armour and Luella Howard, local in Los Angeles. And I listen a lot to Ron Paul and Julius Baker. I like Mozart and Debussy and Ravel a lot. Mm-hmm. Bach and Tchaikovsky and Dvorak.
To continue on.
Now wait till I go to the other side and you're going to really think that I'm schizoid. Mm-hmm. I can tell you the tapes that I took on the road the last time as I make up my own cassettes. Stevie Wonder, Dave Mason, The Who, Sean Phillips, Barbara Streisand, because her voice is like an instrument. She doesn't compose, but her voice is unbelievable. For me, you know, I mean, some people say, oh, it's middle of the road, or this or that, but I think she's incredible. And of course, I always leave people out. McCartney, of all the Beatles, that's...
Paul McCartney.
Yeah, with Wings. I think that's the one that I dig the most, I think.
What do you think of Paul Horn?
That's an interesting question. Some of it I like. There's certain aspects of it that as a flute player,
as you can see in depth what he's
playing. I think it's because he's a clarinet player. And it might be just, that's his instrument. That's what he majored on in school when he went to Oberlin. And he's a doubler, and he's very good at it. And it's probably a prejudice I have because I'm a classical flute player. And I have friends like that I kid and joke with. Fred Seldon, who was in Don Ellis' band, lead alto player for 3 years, and he was a flute pupil of mine. We know each other for years and years. We were in a big marching band together with Jim Gordon, who was with Derek and the Dominoes, and the drummer. And it was with Souther Hillman and Fure, and he was with... Anyway, we're all together. And I taught him how to play flute, and the biggest... Like, last night, he came up to me, and we started joking, and he told me I'd never be a jazz player, and I said, thank God. And then I turned to him, and I said, well, you'll never be a classical flute player. So that's basically what it is, and it's little picky things.
Tim, I'd like to ask you, what happened to your tennis shoes? Does the real Tim Weisberg really like hiking boots better?
Yeah, I thought it would rain. I love tennis shoes. I love tennis shoes. I live in tennis shoes. I just thought it would rain, and I kind of hot and sweaty after the show, and I didn't want to get pneumonia.
Well, good. My image is still intact, then.
Right.
Not
this
just
is
a shtick.
Well, you know, we were back east for 2 months, and we're in a couple of blizzards, and I'll tell you, these Pavetta John Muir trail shoes were great in the snow.
And, now, if the company's only listening,
plug.
I had to pay for them. You know, that thing about getting things for free, I don't know who it happens to, but I haven't found it. It was a myth that I kept hoping, God, when I reach that plateau, you know, gee, maybe when I get the record contract. Well, I've got two albums out now, they'll give me free things. It really doesn't happen that much. Very, very, very seldom. It only, I'm told that it happened back when rock and roll was when the Beatles first happened. That's when the equipment explosion happened and stores started filling up with amps and everybody wanted to play guitars. And the companies were really silly and they gave stuff away to everybody. And so what they did is, you know, just like in politics or anything else, when our change comes, it's 180 degrees the opposite way and, you know, completely, you know, very repressive. Then they didn't give anything away.
Darn.
Yeah. Yeah. And then by the time you get to the place where you're, you know, super big, you need to buy it for a tax write-off then.
Okay, well, I guess we ought to thank Tim Weisberg for being our guest here this evening. He had a rather enthralling concert, two encores, and I believe he really got the Cal Poly audience, and maybe someday in the future we can have him back again. We're doing this live and direct.
And we're taping it, too, probably.
You notice in the other room.
To be held against us at the indictment when we come back, right?
Take the fifth. Thank you, Tim Weisberg. Hope we'll see you again sometime.
You definitely will, and thanks for having me drop by.
Thank you.
We'll boogie, and we'll get the band up here again, for sure.
It'll be really good. Maybe by that time you'll have two lead guitarists.
Hey,
I'm going to try. If Jimmy's in town, we'll just have him boogie up for the afternoon anyway, or the evening, just to do the show.
Get things going really good. And thank you, Blair Helsing, and Cheryl Wright, and Patty Jones, and everyone else in this room.
How was your reception up in the city when you played at Green?
Tim Weisberg interview, January 1, 6, 1977.
Well, welcome to the KCPR studios this evening. It's now 6 o'clock, I presume. With us tonight is a very special guest, a man who's been here once before and who came back at our own little request to have a special encore presentation at KCPR before his concerts tonight, Mr. Tim Weisberg. Good evening.
Yeah, it's good to be here. See, I told you I'd come back.
That's right, you did, as a matter of fact. The last thing you said is you were, I thought it was a threat, though.
Well, actually, it was.
Anyway, also around the table with us, KCPR's own general manager, Mr. Mark Reif, and KCPR's resident Tim Weisberg,
fan club president,
whatever you want to call him.
Jim Allen.
Jim Allen, or Jim Zimmerlin, as he's known in the business. Anyway, get down to a few questions. Welcome back, first off. And do you have anything different planned for tonight than...